For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am very happy to be sitting opposite a faculty colleague this morning, Dr. Peter Dene, a member of the music faculty, and someone who is very busy not only with his sort of normal teaching duties, but also as the coordinator of Carthage's annual Christmas Festival. And we're going to be talking briefly about this year's Christmas Festival, how it will differ from last year's, and about tickets that will go on sale tomorrow. Many fewer tickets than normal because of COVID protocols that will drastically limit the size of the audience that is allowed to be in Siebert Chapel. But nevertheless, we're happy to have members of the community back in Siebert Chapel to enjoy that. So we'll talk briefly about that. But mostly today, we're talking on the morning show about Dr. Dene's experience in Tanzania. He spent a large portion of last year in Tanzania on sabbatical, teaching and doing field research. And it was an extraordinary experience in many different respects. And so we'll be talking with him about that. Dr. Peter Dene, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So glad we can have this conversation. Let's touch on the Christmas Festival first of all, and maybe we should briefly remind people about last year's Christmas Festival, which was extraordinarily different from any Christmas festival in Carthage's history. Remind us of that and what will happen this year, by contrast.
Yeah, so last year, obviously, we were in the midst of COVID protocols, and we were in person in classes and for the most part, and we're rehearsing, but distanced and all of that, and we had canceled the live performance of the Christmas Festival, and actually, I think it was just a couple weeks from now, we had started our recording of the Christmas Festival, so way early, starting to get recordings done. So it was a video production of our Christmas Festival, very true to the original, kept the same sort of format, and but it was different in the term of we had the Christmas Festival set up almost all semester in the chapel in order to be able to record at different points throughout the semester, and when ensembles were ready to perform pieces, we recorded them and then put it all together into a video. And I think it was a very successful production. It certainly was not the same, but it was, I think especially for our seniors, it was important to be able to have done something related to Christmas Festival and not just leave it go. And then for this year, we're going back to live performance, but we're following the protocols that are in place now, and that's the distancing. And so we're less than half of what is normally in the chapel. So chapel typically holds about 1,300 people, and we have about 600 seats available this year. So that's going to drastically limit the number of people who can attend. We've been typically selling out the chapel in previous years, all three nights. And so we're anticipating that the tickets will go fast, and wanted to give everybody a heads up that they go on sale on October 1st. Is that tomorrow?
That is tomorrow.
There you can get them online at the unfortunately I can't give you the email address, but the website, but it's if you go to carthage.edu and do the box office, you'll find it. Tickets are $10. We actually started charging the year before the COVID, charging for the festival, and so they're a $10 charge. And if you want to have dinner, that's $25 more. We're offering dinner all three nights this year.
Mm. And if people go to carthage.edu, there's a little search bar up at the top of the front page, and if you just type in box office, I think it comes up very easily, and it goes from there. But you should probably do it tomorrow. You should probably do it early tomorrow.
I think 7 o'clock is when it opens. The theme this year is "Come to Us, Abide with Us." Comes from "O Little Town of Bethlehem" lyrics, one of the verses. And I'm not going to be able to pull those words out of my head this morning, but that verse really spoke to me last spring when I was thinking about the festival. And it kind of talks about being in the darkness and coming out of that.
Yeah, no, I love that. I think the last verse is, "O Holy Child of Bethlehem, descend to us, we pray. Cast off our sin and enter in, be born in us today."
Yeah, I mean, it's just exquisite. What's interesting is that, you know, I think you think about the words when you sing them at Christmas time, but when you really look at each of those carols that we sing and think about today, I think that that carol in particular, every verse kind of speaks to where we've been in the last year and a half or so, almost 2 years now, and what we hope for in the future.
Yeah, nicely put. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today with Dr. Peter Dene, who is a faculty colleague of mine from the music faculty at Carthage, and coordinator of Carthage's Christmas Festival, among his many duties at Carthage. But we are talking primarily about his experience in Tanzania last year when he was on sabbatical. First of all, we don't have to go into a lot of detail, but I think a lot of our listeners are probably not all that well acquainted with the concept of sabbatical. I mean, maybe in general they are, but probably don't know anything about what's involved in a member of the college faculty securing sabbatical for themselves.
That's a good question. So what's interesting is it's a benefit of being a college professor that you're afforded this opportunity to apply for a sabbatical, and which is typically a semester long, being excused from your teaching duties to focus on some sort of research. And this is, I don't even know, it's like my 30th year as a professor, maybe, or more. I started in my first tenure track position was in 1995. So it's been a while, and I have never taken a sabbatical. And it's typically something that you can do every 5 to 7 years, and I just have never done it. And I thought, I think part of the issue is I don't like letting go of stuff and handing things over to other people. And I finally thought, okay, I trust my colleagues. Everything is going to be okay. I can do this. And then Carthage has had a tradition of students getting Fulbrights. And a student Fulbright is different than a faculty Fulbright. But and I had written several recommendations for students who then got Fulbrights. And so I just started thinking, well, maybe I could take a sabbatical and try and get a Fulbright scholarship to do that. And so, like I said, typically a sabbatical is a semester, and a Fulbright is a commitment of 10 months. So that would mean a whole school year. And so I applied for a full whole academic year sabbatical. And it's a fairly long process. You have to get letters of recommendation from faculty colleagues and your administrators and things like that, and then you have to write a proposal and basically trying to persuade the administration just to say, yes, you're worthy for this and kind of show what you've done at the college. And you also have to have your colleagues and your department chairs say, yes, we can fill this person's position for a year. And so it involves a lot of other people. And the thing is, I applied for the Fulbright before I applied for sabbatical. So a lot of what I wrote for the Fulbright, I was able to then kind of put into my sabbatical request. But I didn't have the Fulbright when I applied for the sabbatical. And even once I was accepted for the sabbatical, I was still waiting to hear from Fulbright whether I was accepted for that. So there were lots of questions up in the air and whether I was going to do it or not. Yeah,
I was about to ask, you know, which was the chicken and which was the egg in terms of first, do you get sabbatical and then do you apply for a Fulbright, or do you apply for a Fulbright and then go to your college? And it sounds like it was happening in a sense somewhat simultaneously.
Yeah, so the Fulbright was due in September of 2019, so that was 2 years ago. And then the sabbatical application was I don't remember when that was due, but I think that was due about the same time probably. But but then I didn't hear from Fulbright until I remember, because I came on your show after that, and it was right around the time when everything started happening with COVID. And so it was one of the things that I was surprised with was when I put on Facebook that I had gotten this Fulbright is the number of people who had responded and, you know, of support. And I think it was because there wasn't a lot of good news at that time.
Right. I remember that vividly. And yes, and it also probably says something about the fact that you don't even have to be in the world of higher education, higher academia to understand what it means to get a Fulbright.
Yeah,
I mean, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're absolutely right. We were all at that point hungry for good news. So so the Fulbright means money.
It means support in lots of different ways, and especially money-wise. I mean, I was able to buy a car when I got there.
To Tanzania.
When I was in Tanzania. And I could never have done that if I didn't have the money from Fulbright to do that. What's interesting, it was a 2004 RAV4, and any time I took a local in my car, they would talk about my new car and how nice my new car was, because most people don't have a car
at all.
And if they do, it's not in great shape. And so this one, it had just come from Japan. A lot of cars in Tanzania come from Japan, and this one had been like a taxi or something, so it was well cared for. And lots of miles on it, lots of kilometers on it, but it was a good car.
Well, thank you, Fulbright, for making that possible. And, of course, you were grateful to Carthage for ultimately granting you sabbatical.
Yes.
Was the process of sabbatical... do you have any sense that was complicated by COVID? I mean, in terms of sabbaticals being granted and that, so on.
Well, I don't think so. I think that happened before COVID. I don't know what happened while I was away. If there was trouble, I know a colleague of mine at Lawrence University was set to do a sabbatical that spring semester when COVID came, and it just kind of totally decimated his plans. He was planning to travel out of the country and do some research at them, and he just couldn't go.
Well, I know that the time frame for your experience in Tanzania underwent some fairly radical change. What was the original plan, and then what happened to that original plan?
Yeah, great. So like I said, it was for 10 months, and the original plan was to leave for Tanzania in mid to late October, and be there for 7 months. For 10 months, and then I think it was maybe late April, early May of 2020 that I got an email. All the Fulbright scholars got an email from Fulbright saying that until further notice, there was nobody approved for traveling on Fulbright, and then it was silent for I thought a long time. because the plan is for Fulbright, you get the award announcement in the spring, and then one of the things you have to commit to is they give you I don't remember what the date was, but I was supposed to go actually to Northwestern for I think a week and do training on basically what to expect and all the different rules related to Fulbright and all of that. And so all of that was canceled too. And so we didn't really hear anything. They kept saying they said they would let us know every month, but I don't think it was longer than that, where we stood. And so it became clear that it wasn't going to be likely to happen in the fall. So I had already been approved for a whole year, and I contacted our dean, Corrine Ness, and said, it looks like I'm going to be here on campus. I'd rather be teaching than just kind of hanging out. And so I was approved to come back to campus and teach. I didn't teach my typical fall load. I taught a different class than I usually do, just because it made it easier.
And, of course, you also coordinated this extraordinary Christmas festival.
That's right. Yeah,
a la COVID, which was, it was great that you could be at the helm for that. I mean, although in some ways I'm sure your previous experience served you well, but
yeah.
It was also a very new adventure for all of us who were involved in it.
There's lots of things that were obviously quite different, but I think you're right. I think having the knowledge of how it's gone and what elements still needed, and especially I think doing it so differently to try and make it seem as much like it's been before, I think that was a benefit for me, being able to be there to help with that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so we started getting, and this was really bad timing, I think, on Fulbright's part. After the school year started, they still didn't approve us to go, but they said that they thought at some point they were going to approve everyone to go. And so they said, we're going to start doing what we're supposed to have been done in the summer during the school during the school year. We were going to do online classes. And so I was teaching full time and basically going to school kind of full time, taking these classes.
And what were the classes?
Well, there were things like how the medical insurance works and how to how to behave. And what to expect, and there was a whole, it was all, Carthage uses Schoology, but lots of schools use another system that I can't remember what it's called now, but it was all on a you had to kind of, there were a series of classes, and you had to do the class online and then take a test and to show that you kind of learned the pertinent stuff for each of those tests, and you had deadlines when you had to do each of those classes.
And it's on this other platform
Right. Oh, man. Yeah, and so I was doing that at the same time, still not knowing if I was going or not. It wasn't until, I really can't give an exact time, but it was fairly late. It was in November that we were notified that people who had been approved for a Fulbright in sub-Saharan Africa could go if you had to submit. So we had, this is like the third time we had to submit what our calendar would be, when we would arrive and when we go and all of that. And so I actually made two proposals, because it wasn't actually, when it was before we had been completely cleared to go, they were saying it looked like we could go sometime in 2021. And so I submitted two proposals, one to leave in January, and then the second one, to arrive in January, and the second one to arrive in March, because that's when their second semester starts. And then when it was approved, I said I want to go with the January dates, but it was late November, and so I had to scramble to get. I still wasn't approved to do a research project in Tanzania by the Tanzanian government. I had submitted all my paperwork, but the week that I submitted the paperwork, or that I was supposed to submit the paperwork, was the same. They had an election the same sort of time that we did last year, and the president shut down the internet system in Tanzania because he didn't want competition.
Oh, dear.
And so the week that I had to submit it, the internet was shut down in Tanzania. And so I actually submitted it late because there was no way to do it. And they accepted it, but then it took them over a month to review it and approve. And it wasn't, I since learned that they never approve anybody's the first time, that they always try and find something wrong with it. And so... So it was kind of preliminary approved, but I had to actually address how what I was doing was not appropriating somebody's culture.
Wow! And to take it back to the United States and use it for your own gain,
right?
Or whatever.
Right, exactly.
Very interesting. I'm a little surprised. It would never have occurred to me that you would need approval. I mean, like, if somebody from Tanzania wanted to come here and research something, they would just come here and do that.
So
and
if they were connected with the university, they'd probably have to get university approval to do the research, but there's no government agency that would have anything to do with it.
Right.
The Tanzanian government is very enmeshed in... It's a way of making money. I had to, another thing that I had to pay quite a bit of money for them to approve it. And so it just took time for it to happen, and I think part of them not accepting it the first time made it seem like it was a real process. And actually, I have a survey that I haven't filled out yet because they sent me a survey a week or so ago. Saying they wanted to improve their process. So I think there could be something there that I could add for that. I don't know if they'll change it or not. But as a quick aside, the president, who I talked about as being kind of anti-democratic in his way of seeking re-election, ended up dying of COVID while I was there.
Wow.
And he actually was a COVID denier and didn't allow there to be any discussion of COVID in the country. And after his death, the person who took over for him was a woman, or is a woman. And she very slowly has integrated that into the discussion. And so it was a very different experience there.
Fascinating. For those of you just joining us, my guest today on The Morning Show is Dr. Peter Dene, a member of the music faculty at Carthage, and we are talking today about his experience on sabbatical in Tanzania last year. So you left in January.
I'm sure that was
a wildly busy wind-up to get everything you needed.
Yeah, it was crazy. The Fulbright helps you get the ticket and all of that stuff, And so just kind of deciding what I was going to bring and what I needed. I was pretty good, but I didn't anticipate everything. And I brought things that I didn't need to bring and all of that stuff. But it was essentially, I think I could have brought less, but been more picky about what I did bring and maybe brought some. The big thing was it ended up being colder than I thought it was going to be, and I didn't really bring stuff for, especially at night when it got cold. Yeah.
Interesting. This is not your first time in Tanzania, nor at all your first time in Africa. You were telling me before we went on the air, this was your 11th trip to Africa. You'd gone 8 times to Namibia, and this was your 3rd time to Tanzania. Did you go in essentially to the same place in Tanzania?
Yeah.
And how did you find that the first time around? What drew you there in the first place?
Right. So the first time I went, I don't know how many times I had been to Namibia before that, but I always used the same, and I always brought students with me when I traveled to Namibia, and I always used the same tour agency. I think it's based in Virginia. And they contacted me and said, we have a special deal for people who've used us before. We want you to we want you to go to Tanzania and see if you could bring students there. And it was a really great deal for about a week in Tanzania. And it was me and two other faculty from other universities, actually in the South. And one was a political science professor and one was a science professor. So we were all in very different fields.
Yeah.
And so they created separate itineraries for each of us. There were some things that overlapped, but some days we would all go in different directions and meet back up again at night. So it was basically, we want to show you Tanzania and we want to show you the kinds of things that you think you'd want to do with students in Tanzania. And it was a really great experience. And they did a really great job of introducing us to the place. And I had never brought a choir to Africa. And I thought, Namibia is the thing about Namibia is there are very few people in Namibia. It's a large country about the size of Texas and Louisiana put together, but there are about 2 million people in the whole country.
Wow.
And so if you bring a choir there, you have to do lots of traveling and there's not a lot of, unless you're in the major cities, there's not a lot of people that would come to hear you. And Tanzania is a big country, but there are also lots of people that live there. I thought, we can do this. We can bring a choir there. So that was my initial goal, and to bring a choir. And we went in 2019 with the treble choir and had a great experience there. And while I was on that tour, one of the things that was on our itinerary was to perform at Tumaini University Makamira, which is just outside of Arusha. And they have an amazing music facility there.
Hmm.
They got money from the European Union to build a beautiful outdoor performance space and three other buildings. And so I met with the director of that place, Randy Stubbs, and said, you know, I think I want to. I've been thinking about it, Fulbright for a long time, and he said, we've actually had several people come and do Fulbrights here, so they were used to that, and
wow.
And so then I followed up on that afterwards.
So your experience in Tanzania was split between teaching and field research.
That's correct.
You touched on the field research since you had to secure permission from the government to engage in that.
Right.
What exactly were you interested in researching there?
So there are. I should just say that as I was putting together the proposal for Fulbright, Fulbright had said, as you're writing your proposal, you should try and reach out to people who have done a Fulbright in your area. And they didn't give us a lot of guidance. I don't think that they're the ones who told me of the person I should contact, but I found this woman in Texas who had actually been to the same university, and she actually, I don't think she's paid by Fulbright, but she recruits people to apply for Fulbright in sub-Saharan Africa. And I didn't know of her until I looked her up, but I sent her my ideas, and she really helped me kind of refine. My initial thought was I wanted to work with the Hadza, which is a tribe that's not too close to Arusha. It's outside of the area, but it's a really unique group of people there. There's nobody else in all of Africa that speaks their language. They have a click language, which people thought was connected to the Bushmen of South Africa, but it's actually, there's no connection. Hmm. And then when they were able to do DNA research there's nobody else in the world actually that has their DNA. They're kind of an individual group of people, and they're very small. They're essentially dying out. And they're truly hunter gatherers, and the men get up in the morning and they go hunting. If they don't get anything, the women go and pick berries and get vegetation, and then that's what they eat. And if the men get something through hunting, then that's what they have. And it's every day is that. And I did record some music when I met them in 2019. So my original proposal was to work with them, and she really steered me away from that and told me, you know, said, do something closer and focused on what you're really good at, and that music at is my thing. And so I changed it to these three indigenous groups that are in north central Tanzania, the Chaga, which are, they're mainly located in the foothills of Kilimanjaro, and then the Meru, which are in the foothills of Mount Meru, which is I think the fifth largest mountain in Africa. And it's actually one that I saw every day. It was right outside of my house. And then the Maasai, which a lot of people know about the Maasai. They're a very large group that actually spreads into Kenya as well. And they're kind of north and west of Arusha.
And so what was it that you were intending to do?
Oh, great.
And how were you going to engage with them?
Yeah, so I connected with, there's a person who works at the university, who his job is kind of he teaches one class in the music department, but he also then is putting together this archive that they have of indigenous music from Tanzania. And so I worked with him to I told him, you know, this is what I want to do. And and so he started just calling people and saying, we want to do this. And so he would find a group that would be able to sing for me. And we'd go out, and usually on a Saturday or Friday, and just drive. Typically, so I'd take my car, my RAV4, and like when we go into the Kilimanjaro, essentially, you know, you're on the main road getting to where you, and then you turn off on a gravel road, and the gravel road gets more more not quite gravel, and then eventually it gets kind of down to a two-lane path, and then it gets down to a footpath, there were several times where I just kept driving till I couldn't, the path got so narrow I couldn't drive my car through anymore, and then my colleague would get out and go find them and bring them to me.
Wow.
Yeah, and so they'd come and sing and perform music. And for the Maasai, it was a little bit different. There were times, the last Maasai group that I went to was actually a colleague of mine who's getting his doctorate in Germany, and he's Maasai himself, and he wanted to bring me to his hometown, which is very near the Kenyan border. And so we drove up there together and spent a couple of days. And what was interesting is he already has he's got a master's in both music and divinity. And so he had converted to Christianity. So there was this was the first time that I had, I wasn't quite feeling welcomed in the community because they were doing a traditional ceremony, sacrificing a cow, they felt that because I was with him, that we were judging them, and so there was some. Actually, I got somebody yelled at me at one point. I didn't realize what was going on, my colleague's name is Salulu. He became a good friend of mine, and he then stepped away from me and had someone who had been a teacher, a retired teacher, who was actually taller than I am, and he basically just shadowed me the rest of the time and stood next to me, and that made it okay that this guy who was respected in the community was with me.
Wow, interesting.
Yeah.
So you were mostly studying their music,
right? Yeah. So I would record. With the Maasai, it was almost always a ceremony. It was some, so I wasn't, they weren't performing for me. They were performing for whatever. The first one that I went to was actually, I was very fortunate. This only happens like once every 20 years or so. The circumcision ceremony for boys.
Wow.
And this was actually the initial ceremony. So it takes over a year to get to the final ceremony where the circumcision happens, but this was the opening ceremony, and we had gone to a community, and we got there really early in the morning, and the whole thing started with slaughtering two cows and then preparing the food, and the women prepare their own food, and the men prepare their own food, and they let me videotape everything and be a part of as much as I wanted to be. I was trying not to eat the food, but I typically try to eat the food that's there, but the Maasai, they like raw things, and they also drink the blood of cows, and that's part of their tradition. I didn't drink any blood, but I had some meat that I struggled with eating.
I'm sure. Wow.
But it was, I mean, they had given it, I was in a small room with the heads of the community, and the leader was very upset that they weren't taking better care of me, and I kept saying, I don't want to be even noticed here. I mean, I mean, he didn't understand me, and I didn't understand. We had a translator, and I said, "That's not my point in being here. You don't have to. It can be that I'm not even here." And he just wanted me to have some meat, and so they finally came in, and it was presented to me on a stick, and it was a big chunk of meat. That was kind of speared by this stick, and it was surrounded by branches of a kind of herb, the leaves, green leaves, on it, and a machete, and so I was given the machete, and I was supposed to cut the meat off, and I was supposed to eat the first piece, and then give it to everybody else, and I could hardly do it. I cut off too big a piece for me for the first one, but it's kind of semi-cooked, and it's just in general the beef in Tanzania is not how we typically have beef. It's very, very tough and very sinewy. So my colleague who traveled with me all the time, I said to him, and he's also Maasai, and I said to him, I'm going to give this to you because you can do it better than me. And I said, I'm not going to do anything more with this. And so he then kind of distributed it to everybody else. But the big thing then was that, so the three men who were kind of the heads of the whole community, they then brought in this meat that was even less cooked and more just like, almost like the hide, and it was, and they insisted on giving me a piece of that, and I put it in my mouth, and I just couldn't do it, so I just kept it in my mouth, and when things got kind of loud, I took it out of my mouth and kind of threw it. The floor is dirt. I was sitting on a chair that was about less than a foot off the ground, and there are dogs that come around, so I just figured a dog would come and take care of it for me. But typically, that's not typically how I would behave in a community like that. And nobody saw that I was doing it, and I was very gracious, but I just couldn't do it.
Wow. Well, that just kind of underscores how far from home you were.
And
what a dramatically different culture this was, in which you were, in a sense, immersing yourself.
Exactly.
At the end of your research, did you end up, in a sense, creating something?
So I'm in the process of creating. That was the Maasai experience. They never kind of, just because I was there, did something. And the other two groups, the Chaga and the Meru, they're more connected with 21st century culture. During the day they typically just wear Western style dress, and so they, when I went to visit them, they were performing for me. So all three experiences were We'd have two video cameras and a camera, and I also used my iPad, and we recorded everything. And then I'm still in the process of kind of putting all that together. I've shared some of it already, but my goal is to create, and this was part of my proposal to both for both my sabbatical and for Fulbright, was to create teaching and learning resources to be used in the schools to teach the music of these cultures and about the cultures themselves in the school. Mm. So I'm still working on that part of it.
Wow. No small feat.
Right.
And now you're back to full-time
right,
duties here at Carthage.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
Yeah.
In addition to this field research, you were also, of course, teaching in
yes.
Tanzania. We just probably have a couple of minutes to talk about that, but
wow.
you were teaching at this university, and you were telling me before we went on the air that those duties were pretty relentless.
Yes, yeah.
And what kinds of things were you teaching there, and what was it like to teach in a setting like that?
So I arrived on January 4th. I think that was a Monday, and I started teaching on January 5th. And
wow.
And I didn't really have a clear understanding of what it was I was going to be teaching until I got there. Mm. And there was a group of six students that I had as students the whole time I was there. So there were some other classes where I had different students, but these six were kind of what we would consider the seniors. And so when I first got there, I was teaching a course called Composition and Arranging. And research, writing a research proposal, and there was a third class. I conducted the choir, which was called Western Music Ensemble. But what I quickly learned, so I had this whole plan for teaching the composition and arranging, and even kind of what we might consider the best student had very limited ability to read music, to look at a score and know how to interpret that. So I'm teaching a composition arranging class and basically had to start in a different place, I think. And we had lots of conversations about it because I wanted to value their experience and where they were. In Tanzania, there are very few opportunities to learn music in the schools. And so most of them hadn't started playing an instrument or learning music until they were like 19, after they were done with school.
Hmm.
And most of my students averaged about the 26 or 27 years old. So they're, again, another difference. They were very mature. And so just kind of thinking about that and rethinking what composition and arranging is and how do I get to that with students who don't have what I would have thought were the kind of the fundamentals needed for that. And we ended up writing some really great music together. We did a lot of stuff together.
Huh.
And it was neat.
And the language barrier was handled
that
with
was
a translator?
So Tumaini University is an English language.
Oh.
And it's actually affiliated with the Lutheran Church as well. But it's all courses are supposed to be taught in English. I know that there are some that are not.
Hmm.
But the music experience, the ability to understand English among the students that I worked with was a range.
And
some this was their first time having to converse in English kind of consistently.
Yeah.
So there were some times where I'd say, can you say that in Swahili for me to one of the students?
Sure.
Yeah.
Wow. So this is, you know, sort of the twin responsibilities you had doing
yes.
this teaching, doing this field research, and it all sounds amazing. And, of course,
yeah,
in a beautiful country. I know that towards the end, unfortunately, you became ill.
Yes.
And I know this was a little bit of an adventure in and of itself, and not the kind of adventure anybody certainly seeks out. We should quickly say it was not COVID.
It wasn't.
But there were ways in which it resembled COVID,
and that
obviously was a really frightening possibility for
right.
you.
Right. It never was fully diagnosed or diagnosed at all, I mean, even when I got back to the U.S. And they think it was some kind of coronavirus, but not COVID. Because my lungs responded the same way someone might if they had kind of severe COVID. And it happened on July 11th. I started getting sick, and I was in Dubai at the time. I had to leave Tanzania in order to renew my visa. You have to go out of the country and then come back in. Mm. And so I had left and gone to Dubai, and I was going to be there. I was there for 7 days, and on the fifth day, I got sick. And the reason that I and the doctors are fairly certain it's not COVID is because I had had two tests before. I had a test before I left for Dubai. I had a test when I arrived in Dubai. I had a test on the day that I got sick in order to, I was going to be leaving in 2 days. And then I had a test when I got to the airport in Tanzania, and all of them were negative. And then before leaving for the U.S. on July 28th, I had another COVID test, and all of them came back negative. But I was essentially, when it was at its worst, I had fevers over 103 and couldn't breathe, and would wake up in the middle of the night just trying to get breath. And I came home. I was still quite sick. My wife was in a bit of a panic when she saw me. And
I bet that wasn't a fun flight home.
No, it was not at all. You know, and I can, I mean, I can understand now when people say, I think there are, because I was one of them, wearing a mask and struggling with breathing, I felt like the mask just made it so much worse. And I felt like I couldn't breathe. And there were times when I pulled it down over my nose just because I felt like I needed to breathe. Hmm. Just a quick example of how I think I must have looked to people is when I was in the airport leaving Kilimanjaro Airport, I was in line to you have to go through customs to leave, and there was only one window open when I got there, and there was a big long line, and at some point another man came to open another window, and I was probably like 20th in line, and he got opened the window, and he pointed at me, and he said, "He goes first," and They let me go through the whole, and I kind of apologized to each person as I was walking through the line. But I was actually sitting on my heels, which I never do, because I couldn't stand, and I was so exhausted. So the good report is that I've done lots of doctor things in the month of August, and my next one is until October. But he was confident when I met him that thing I was getting better, and I know that I am now. I couldn't have had this conversation just like 3 weeks ago.
Just the act of this much talking
exactly
would have been too taxing.
Yeah, I did a presentation for the Kenosha Public Library about 2 weeks after I got back. Well, maybe it was a week before classes started, and I said I wanted to do it to see if I would be able to teach classes. And that I was very much struggling there, and I had to, about 5 minutes in, I had to stop and say, "You're seeing me gasping for air. Just know that I'm okay, and that I want to get through this." And I did get through it, but it was a challenge, and I don't have that experience anymore. So that's a good sign.
Wow. Well, I'm glad that most of your memories of Tanzania, aside from some of the food, are so positive,
yeah,
and that it was
sure,
such a tremendous experience for you. And glad also that you've made such a robust recovery from this really scary illness that came at the very end of this remarkable time that you had in Tanzania, teaching and doing research. And we look forward to hearing more about the fruits of that research. We want to reiterate that Dr. Peter Dene also coordinates Carthage's Christmas festival, the theme of which this year is "Come to Us, Abide with Us." And unlike last year because of COVID, this year, members of the community can be there in the audience, but it's a very limited number of tickets that will be sold, and they go on sale tomorrow. You go to carthage.edu, do a search for the box office, and that's where you can reserve your tickets for the Carthage Christmas Festival, which I assume is the first weekend in December.
That's correct, yes.
All right. Dr. Peter Dene, it's been great to talk with you about this experience that you had. It was so fun to see various photographs that you posted on Facebook and other information you shared about your adventures in Tanzania. And we're just glad that it all worked out so very well that you got to go at all.
Yeah, right.
And I'm so glad that you join me today on the morning show to share these stories. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
We want to remind you that the morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock, and the program is archived on our website, which is wgtd.org. And you can also subscribe to the morning show in its podcast format and hear a different morning show 7 days a week. Be sure that you look for the morning show with